And welcome to NC State's Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. The summer of 2026 has seen ongoing cyclosporiasis outbreaks that are changing the way a lot of us are looking at salads, berries, and where we get our fresh produce. We're speaking today with Leanne Jacobs, William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor Emerita at NC State, about cyclospora, a tiny parasite with a big impact on our health. Welcome, Leanne.
Thanks, Tracy. I'm delighted to be here today.
I am super glad to have you here because I know everybody is dying to know more about this tiny little parasite, Cyclospora. So let's start off by talking about it. What is it? What's its life cycle like? And how does it make us so sick?
So I'm a food microbiologist with expertise in food safety, and we generally look at microorganisms that cause foodborne disease in three different categories, okay? So viruses, bacteria, and then parasitic protozoa. And Cyclospora falls in that last category. Most people don't really think about parasitic protozoa as agents of foodborne disease. They're much more familiar with bacteria like Salmonella and E. coli. So parasitic protozoa are a little bit quite a bit different than bacteria and viruses. They're much larger. They're actually what we call eukaryotic, not prokaryotic. They also are much more complex, okay? Cyclospora falls in that category of parasitic protozoa, and it causes disease in humans that shows manifestation of what is termed explosive diarrhea.
Yeah. That's the headline. Yes, indeed.
There are a couple other features about that, in that that diarrhea oftentimes is remitting. So you might have it for a while and then not, and then it comes back and then not, and then it comes back. And also it usually has a pretty long duration. It can be as long as 4 weeks. And that is not typical for most foodborne pathogens that cause gastrointestinal symptoms.
So what is it about it that makes it so special? Like, we know bacteria, they get in there and they just multiply and wreak havoc. So what is this little guy doing?
So this little guy has a really interesting life form and actually means by which it causes infections in humans. First thing, sort of a take home, is this only, to our knowledge, only infects humans. There isn't an animal host for Cyclospora, at least that we know of so far. What actually happens is people consume the sporulated oocysts of the organism, okay? And sporulated is the key word. Once it gets into the gastrointestinal tract, then the spores kind of fall apart and they go through a very complicated life cycle that involves many different sort of manifestations of the organism. And that's what gives you the symptoms. And then once you're infected, you will shed unsporulated oocytes in your fecal material, okay? And that serves as sort of the ultimate source of contamination if it's in a field, let's say, where you're producing a product like lettuce. But the kicker here, and this is what's so unique, is that the unsporulated oocysts are not infectious. So there is a period of time, and maybe for lack of a better word I'm going to use, it's the sporulation phase, but it's almost like a maturation phase, where the unsporulated oocyst becomes sporulated. And it's the sporulated cysts that actually cause illness. So it's different than just fecal contamination, because you have to have fecal contamination followed by environmental conditions that promote sporulation of the oocysts.
And that was the question that would be like I would want to follow up with, which is, you know, what do we know what makes them sporulate yet? Do we have any ideas about that?
Sporulation in general as a principle, and there are bacteria that are that sporulate as well, is usually, almost always, a function of or a response from an organism due to stress, okay? And that's normally environmental stress. We don't know a lot about the triggers for sporulation for Cyclospora, in part because it's really hard to study it, and we'll talk about that later. But things like temperature, particularly elevated temperature, moisture content, either dry conditions or extremely wet conditions. So mostly these environmental factors will promote that sporulation process, and sporulation can take days to weeks.
You know, that brings us back to the main question that everybody's asking, which is how is this stuff getting into our food supply? Like, do we have any ideas, really, what's setting them off? And, you know, how common are these outbreaks, I guess?
So, yeah, that's like four questions.
I know. I tend to pile them on one another. Sorry about that.
So that's okay. So let me give you a little background on Cyclospora sort of historically, okay? We didn't even know anything about this organism until around 2000, and it was associated with a couple of outbreaks associated with Guatemalan raspberries. And I remember teaching food microbiology and like having to talk about this for the first time. I'm like, nobody's ever heard of this, okay? And then since that time, we have pretty much had outbreaks almost every year. The three product types that are almost virtually always associated with outbreaks are either berries, leafy greens, or herbs. These are all products, number one, that are consumed raw, okay? And there have been a couple of other sort of niche things like snap peas, but really those are the three that we think about. And the illness is extremely rare. It has an incidence rate of about 0.3 per 100,000 population. What that means is in any one year, you have one infection out of 300,000 people. So that's a rare disease. And it has very strong seasonality, okay? And that seasonality is in the summer months of the year. So you begin to see cases in May or June, and you really stop seeing cases in by the end of September.
So does that mean that for all of the cases we've seen, like in a state like Michigan?
Michigan has had the most.
Michigan's
cases.
Had the most. So for all of that, all the people who've been sickened, that they've managed to say, yes, indeed, this is what you do have, there are that many more who could have been exposed to it and just didn't get ill? Or do we not know that yet?
So keep in mind that the incidence rate of you know, 0.3 per 100,000 population is sort of the mean over a period of time where CDC has been keeping records, okay? We have starting in around 2017, we've started to see an uptick in those numbers of cases, okay? What we've seen this year is so far beyond anything we've seen. That's going to kick up the incidence rate. But your point is really, really well taken, because in general, when there is a foodborne disease outbreak, particularly a diarrheal disease that oftentimes people often don't even go to their doctors, there's always more cases than are actually diagnosed. Right. So the fact that we've had, and I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's in the thousands in Michigan and in Ohio. And there's talk on the street that we're talking potentially in the tens of thousands of diagnosed cases. So that would mean that there is probably a lot more of that in the population that just simply goes undiagnosed.
Wow. Well, okay, so that brings us back to the main question, which is, how is this stuff getting into our food supply? I mean, we know what it tends to show up on. We've got berries, we've got leafy produce and herbs and things that we eat raw. And, you know, everyone refers to it as the poop lettuce. But this, we're not out here, you know, how How does it get into the food supply? How does this happen?
Okay, so if I had the answer to that, I would probably I would be on television
multiple times.
The answer to that is we don't entirely know. Okay, so we do know that these larger outbreaks are almost always associated with product that is grown, that is imported into the United States, and is grown in tropical or subtropical regions. Okay, so Central and South America and Asia. Okay, probably because the microorganism is more endemic in those countries, so more people are infected. Clearly, there has to be a human fecal contamination event, and ways that can happen are overflow of untreated sewage. That kind of happens frequently in association with floods, for example, okay? Or some type of deposition of human fecal matter, maybe due to runoff, again, due to a lot of water. Somebody defecating in a field, that's another possibility. But because of that sporulation phase, okay, that's just how it gets on there, right? Okay, gets in the environment. Because of that sporulation phase, you got to have environmental conditions after the deposition of the fecal matter that promote the formation of the spores, which, again, makes it completely unique from any other foodborne pathogen, but it also means you kind of have to have the perfect storm to get this to happen. But we honestly don't know, even in outbreaks that we have, investigated, exactly how this is happening.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. It's the perfect storm, but we just don't know what the storm is.
Right.
Okay. Right. Great. So, we know what has to be happening somewhere, somehow, for this to get into our food supply and make us sick. Why is it so difficult to identify an outbreak?
So identification of an outbreak, okay, and identification of this microorganism itself are two different things, but they're both important and they're both complicated. So if you're trying to identify an outbreak, first of all, you have to identify a cluster of cases, okay, that are associated mostly in time and space, okay, and for which there's a common food. So that the first step is public health folks, get reports of diagnoses, and they recognize a cluster, and then they go out and they do surveys or interviews of the patients to get a feel for what their exposure was. In this case, what foods or where did you eat or et cetera and so on. So one of the complications, and that's classic. That's how these investigations are done. One of the problems with Cyclospora is that it has what is called an extended incubation period. And that is the time from when somebody consumes it to when they get their first symptoms. So the mean incubation period is 7 days, but it can go out as long as 10 days. So if you're asking somebody who's been sick for a week what they ate literally 2 weeks ago, most people don't remember it, let alone where they were, what brand it was, et cetera, and so on. So that's one complication. A second complication is that many of these products have a really complicated supply chain. Think about bagged lettuce that has maybe five different types of lettuce in it, okay? Well, each of those types of lettuce is coming from a different place. So not only do you identify bagged lettuce as the problem, let's say, okay, but then you got to identify which of the ingredients in there caused the illness. So that's a further complication. And then finally, you have to trace it back, okay, to the source. Now, we have increasingly good traceability capabilities in our country, and they're getting better due to upcoming traceability legislation. But the reality is that's tough sometimes to trace something all the way back through the chain.
And sort of the related question, we kept hearing about this, like, quote unquote, false positive that the FDA got. And I would assume that that's just sort of what can happen when you've got all of these moving parts going at the same time?
So the false positive for FDA actually falls into more into that category of difficulties in detecting the microorganism. Okay, so one thing that impacts the investigation of an outbreak is that this is not an, you know, we talked about how rare it is. It's not a microorganism for which we have a highly accessible clinical diagnostic. So even in the early days, it was very hard for people to even be formally diagnosed. That's getting a little bit better because there are so many cases. But at the same time, because for a number of reasons, probably the biggest one is that there is no animal model for Cyclospora, and you cannot grow it in the lab. You can't. So that means you must rely on molecular detection methods, and those are complicated, particularly when you have very small amounts of contamination occurring in a sample of lettuce. So you have sampling issues. Do you even get a sample that you can test or a sample that has the Cyclospora on it? And then you're using a test that has relatively poor sensitivity because there's not much there and you can't grow it. Okay, so that is another perfect storm thing that leads to the fact that it's very hard to actually confirm that it's present in the product. So the false positive was just basically release of results a little sooner than they should have. But from a scientific perspective, not unexpected at all.
All right. So, you know, we can't grow it. So diagnosing it, it's not like they could take a sample from an infected patient and like swipe it on a petri dish and try to grow it out. That doesn't happen. It's not like strep throat or whatever you do.
Nope.
Okay. It's hard to find. We're not sure why, you know, what the perfect storm is that's making it more prevalent in the food supply. So what can we do, if anything, to maybe prevent the outbreaks? Like, are there things that we could do to help us trace, you know, improve traceability, trace them more quickly? And what can average people do?
So let's break that question down.
My multi-part question. Yes.
Yeah. So the first part is, this is another really important thing in foodborne disease in general. We tend to divide our strategies to prevent into prevention versus control. So you want to prevent the product from getting contaminated in the first place, and then if the pathogen is present, you want to inactivate it or find a way to kill it. So let's talk about a tiny bit about the biology of Cyclospora, which is that it is a pathogen that is extraordinarily resistant to disinfection. And to most of the kind of classic methods that we might use to inactivate it other than heat. Now, that's within the confines of what we know about it because we don't know a lot about it. It's certainly not going to be inactivated by washing it with low chlorine content wash water, which is what they oftentimes use, or by just simply washing it in your sink. And in point of fact, a classic thing that we talk about all the time is that washing your produce is never going to be 100%, is never going to result in 100% removal of pathogens. That's not to say you shouldn't do it.
Right.
It's just saying don't rely on it to completely get rid of things. So if those control measures don't work very well, we really have to rely on prevention. Okay, which is always going to be preventing human fecal matter from getting onto produce, okay, or getting into growing fields. And that's your sort of your primary prevention strategy. And then also better understanding about those environmental factors that, you know, that are important for the sporulation process. But keep in mind that the countries that these products are coming from don't have the strict hygiene controls like water and sewage treatment that we have here in the United States. So that becomes very, very difficult because we have a global food supply. We are now used to getting berries year-round. When I was a kid, you had strawberries in May. That was it.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's sort of a related question that I was thinking about. You know, you were talking about how it's endemic in certain populations. If you're someone who's had cyclosporiasis, right, you've had it in your body, do you have it for, like, do you shed it forever? Are you the problem? Do you know what I mean going forward? Like, does it persist in you forever? Because it must be circulating through the population.
That's an extraordinarily good question. And the answer is we just don't know, okay? I don't think...
I mean, I don't think anybody's going to be out there, you know, pooping in a field, but still.
Yeah, we don't know. It's, you know, something the scope of this particular outbreak almost always sort of it leans in the direction of there has to have been a massive fecal contamination event for this much product to have been involved. So that sort of speaks to some kind of a sewage overflow or you know, runoff from rains or floods or something like that. But again, we don't know that for sure. So prevention, absolutely, but actually doing that in these regions of the world is complicated.
Right. So for the average grocery shopper in North Carolina, let's say, or anywhere, I say North Carolina because that's where we are. What can we do if we really want some raspberries?
Well, you can cook them. Yeah. My colleague Ben Chapman cooks his fresh and frozen berries when he makes smoothies, so you can cook them. But you're not going to cook lettuce, right?
Right.
This is what I have told people when I have been posed this question, and I'm definitely not a doomsdayer by any stretch of the imagination. I think you have to approach this, number one, are you seeing significant clusters in your region of the country? Actually, for example, Wake County is seeing pretty big clusters, okay? They don't yet know what's causing it, but they are seeing some big clusters. So you have to consider where it appears to be a problem, and then you also need to consider how risk-averse you are. Okay, I would say if you are elderly or if you are immunocompromised in any way, you might want to stay away from those products that could be risky, okay? If if you're young and healthy and are raising a family, there is an antibiotic regimen that can be used to treat cyclospora, and it's very effective. So so you decide what degree of risk you're willing to go with. And then I think you just keep your eyes open. You know, if you develop explosive diarrhea that lasts for a couple of days, go to the doctor. Okay. The antibiotic that's used is a common antibiotic. The test is a little bit trickier to get, but I suspect that you would be treated pretty rapidly.
Okay. So what are some of the questions around this organism and these outbreaks that we still need to answer? And you've gone through some of the complications here, but, you know, tell us more. Like, what do we still need to know, and what's difficult about finding out that information?
So keep in mind sort of the structure when we have an outbreak. There is that crosses states. Okay, when you have a foodborne outbreak that crosses states, there is a federal and state structure that kind of goes into place. So the state. State, local, and federal public health, like CDC and North Carolina Department of Public Health, are doing their thing in terms of finding cases and making associations. Okay, the Agriculture Department and the Food and Drug Administration are responsible for number one, helping companies to get the product off the market, but also to figure out what happened. And that is actually something called root cause analysis. And the FDA for an outbreak like this is going to be highly focused on root cause analysis. So they're going to go to the farm. They're going to interview people on the farm. They're going to try to figure, I'm sure they're going to look at geospatial patterns. They're going to look at climactic things. They're going to look at, were there floods, big rains, whatever. That is an attempt to try to piece together the story of how this happened. Okay. And interestingly, I have probably half a dozen of the people that I've trained work for the FDA teams that do that kind of work.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you'll know what's happening when it's happening, hopefully.
Yeah, I can't say anything.
Well, it just makes me feel better that somebody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
So that's great. So this brings me to my final question, which is a question that I ask every single person who comes on this podcast. And it is, what is the coolest or the grossest or the most concerning thing that you know about Cyclospora?
I have to say that the most interesting thing about it is the whole movement from the oocyst stage to the sporulated oocyst stage in the environment, because that's just not, we have never had to consider that in a foodborne outbreak ever. So to me, that's the fascinating part about it. And then, that's my kind of microbiology hat. Okay. If I put my public health hat on it, we know nothing about its circulation in human populations. I think that is like so important and so needed to understand. And if I put my agriculture hat on, it's how the heck is this stuff getting into the produce?
Right? That's the kicker. So this is a related question, and I just need to sort of picture how this works in the human body, because you talk about it starts as an oocyst and then it becomes sporulated. And the sporulated form is what makes us sick. So help me kind of picture that, because I picture the oocyst as like a little egg in a shell, little egg. And that's okay. That's not going to hurt you, right? If you eat lettuce with a non-sporulated oocyst on it, does that oocyst then sporulate in your body?
No.
Okay.
It's difficult to know where to start with the story. So let's start the story with somebody consuming the sporulated oocyst.
Okay.
Okay. For whatever reason, that is what makes a person sick. Okay. So that goes into the body, and that spore has a really thick shell on it. So that goes into the body. The body breaks it down. There's a whole bunch of different life phases of it, and that's what's causing the symptoms. And what ends up being excreted in fecal material is the oocyst, but without the big, heavy spore coat on it. So, and that oocyst can't infect, okay, without that big, heavy spore coat. So it is the it is that environmental period where the oocyst sporulates, gets that heavy coat that makes it infectious.
Okay.
And then that infectious oocyst is on the produce and the cycle starts again.
And here we go.
Yeah.
Hold on to your hats, I guess. Well, I mean, this has been very illuminating, as much as we can illuminate it, because it's something that is still kind of a mystery. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to find out what's going on with this thing as we continue to study it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So
I was delighted to be here.
Today.
This was really fun.
A lot of fun. I mean, as fun as explosive diarrhea can be, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. We've been speaking today with Leanne Jacus, William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor Emerita here at NC State. This has been Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. Thank you so much for listening.